Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life 1 week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Jordan Calhoun, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And today we are coming to grips with our pandemic anxiety.
And we're learning just how to handle that anxiety with some useful tools.
Yes, and helping us do that today is psychologist Dr. Elena Welsh.
You know, this fight or flight response was developed to keep us safe in real predatory situations. And mammals don't worry in the way that we do. So what's happening with all our stress-related diseases is I'm worried about losing my job, losing my home, being homeless. My body thinks that's really happening. My body's like, oh, we're in danger, freak out. And that's where the stress hormones are released.
Dr. Welsh is a clinical psychologist based in LA who specializes in a wide range of anxiety, mood, and depressive disorders. She's also the author of several books, including Trauma Survivor's Strategy for Healing, 5-Minute Stress Relief, and the Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Workbook for Panic Attacks.
We'll also hear from CBT pioneer Dr. David Burns. David is currently an adjunct clinical professor emeritus of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Stanford University School of Medicine and has won numerous awards for his research in the field of psychiatry and brain chemistry.
And what we've discovered is that people get stuck in depression, also anxiety and relationship problems and habits and addictions for different reasons. But people get stuck in depression and anxiety because your symptoms are actually the expression of what's most beautiful and awesome about you.
We interviewed Dr. Burns in 2018 about his first book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy. His latest book, which just came out, is called Feeling Great, The Revolutionary New Treatment for Depression and Anxiety.
Alice, on a scale of 1 to 10, where's your pandemic anxiety at?
Oh my goodness. Well, it's not just pandemic anxiety anymore. It's a heady mix of political anxiety, environmental anxiety, pandemic anxieties in there, sure.
Yeah. A nice cornucopia of anxiety.
School starting anxiety. Winter is coming anxiety. I mean, how can you choose?
Why only have one type when you can have 17?
So true. How about you? How's your anxiety going? And what different sections of the pie are you enjoying these days?
Let's see. In my fruitcake of anxiety, I actually think I'm pretty okay right now. I think this is the quiet before the winter storm. Mm-hmm. I think being socially distant and relatively isolated with, you know, little contact with the outside world was not as bad in the summer as it's going to be once we're heading into winter and the days are 3 hours long and the sun sets at 5 o'clock. So I'm right now feeling relatively good in preparation for how bad I might feel in about 2 or 3 more months.
Well, I think the whole idea of the day being 3 hours long is what Dr. Burns would call distorted thinking.
Yeah, I might be exaggerating slightly. The day is maybe 4 or 5 hours.
Exactly. I mean, 3.5 at least.
The glass is a quarter full.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, this is an amazing, amazing time to really explore our anxieties, really feel it as hard as we ever are going to.
Well, I think Dr. Welsh and Dr. Burns are hopefully going to be the ones to help us with our array of anxieties. So how about it? Let's get into it.
Let's do it. Dr. Welsh, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks again for having me.
So for people who don't know, tell us, what is CBT and how does it work?
So CBT is a form of therapy. We like to call it evidence-based just because it's been around a while. So it has a good body of kind of scientific literature that now supports its effectiveness. So the basic premise behind CBT is that your thoughts, behaviors, your emotions are all interconnected. So if you're intervening, really, you can intervene at any point. Then if you change your behavior, it's going to have subsequent changes for your emotions and your thoughts. If you change your thoughts, you're going to have changes in your behavior and your emotions. So just that everything is interconnected. So CBT, in terms of, again, where we're trying to make changes, usually it starts with looking at the thoughts and behaviors. So particularly with disorders like anxiety, a lot of times our thought patterns are what kind of kick off this cascade of then physical symptoms because our body is prompted to think we're in danger. So if we can even do a little bit of modifying of the thoughts that automatically come up in kind of worry provoking or anxious situations, then you're kind of, again, shifting subsequently your behavior and your emotions and your physiological reaction. So of course the body is kind of in there too, even though it's not explicitly addressed in CBT.
Can you talk about some of the opportunities or limitations even of CBT? Are there particular people for whom this is particularly effective with? Is there a certain time commitment before you start seeing substantial results? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think some of the major criticisms for the research evidence is that it's pretty kind of regimented. So anytime we show effectiveness through research, usually it's a very kind of controlled group. You can't also have substance use issues, you know, so trying to keep it clean because it's so hard to figure out what's affecting what in psychological research. So some of the critiques are when you see it working so effectively, that's for like your model patient, but really most folks are a little bit messier. So change is a little harder to kind of come by. The other critique and, you know, frankly, reality, I think, is that CBT is very symptom management focused. So what it's great at is giving you that initial relief in your symptoms. What takes a little more time, but I think that can be done with CBT as long as you're augmenting with other kind of psychotherapies, but is maybe more the domain of a different orientation of psychotherapy, like a kind of psychodynamic therapy that's looking more at where did this come from? Like what kind of childhood stuff is this bringing up? How did you learn this? So kind of going back a little bit more for some of that maybe deeply rooted pain that usually our thoughts are kind of giving us hints as to what's deep down there. But that takes a little more work and isn't as conducive to working with our kind of CBT can get a little regimented, which is honestly what works because you have to be really consistent in some of this stuff to see a reduction in symptoms. But that's, I'd say, the balance that we're walking and when it can be helpful to bring in, you know, other forms of therapies or other approaches after you've had that initial symptom control and maybe you're in a place where you're more stable to explore some of the underlying beliefs or, you know, pain that you might have, you know, from early experiences or traumatic experiences or that more complex stuff. But I think CBT is excellent at just helping people get a core kind of toolbox of skills for how to manage, you know, anxiety as it comes up, not let it totally take control of you. And then there's other things that can kind of come in later once you're just not so hijacked by that anxiety and really have the space to even look at other things that might be going on.
And I think right now, so many of us are hijacked by anxiety, right? Whether or not that's because of deep-seated issues or just the reality we're living in, the world we're currently in today. And also we're kind of in this position where we're not very mobile. We may not necessarily be able to get to a therapist or spend the time to really dig in deeper. So for those people, and really for all of us, are there techniques we can use on a daily basis, on a weekly basis to kind of get started with CBT, maybe address some of that pandemic anxiety, political anxiety, whatever it might be?
What's really tricky for me working with clients with the pandemic anxiety is a lot of the work around anxiety is figuring out what am I kind of exaggerating versus what's a real threat. So when we're taking an example like social anxiety, usually it's very easy for me to kind of point out this ballooned anxiety you know, expectations of I'm going to stutter, they're going to laugh at me, no one's going to talk to me again, I'm going to be lonely. And it goes like so dramatically out that it's very easy to kind of pull it back and say, yes, you might be embarrassed, but like really, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? With COVID, it's really tricky for folks that already had some kind of health anxiety stuff, because we just don't have the data. There is a genuine threat there to folks' health. So it's much trickier for me to just say that's your anxiety, you know, talking. So that's a part of the struggle that we're working with is there is just so much going on, and there is real pause, you know, real reason for concern, unfortunately, in many cases. So it's just not making it worse on ourselves. So it's kind of being as balanced as possible again. So part of what I think can help for everybody is to just understand what happens with the fight or flight response and what happens with our worrying. So in that famous book, Zebras, Don't Get Ulcers by Robert Sapolsky, he really introduced to us the idea that, you know, this fight or flight response was developed to keep us safe in real predatory situations. And mammals don't worry in the way that we do. So what's happening with all our stress-related diseases is I'm worried about losing my job, losing my home, being homeless. My body thinks that's really happening. My body's like, oh, we're in danger, freak out. And that's where the stress hormones are released. Your heart might start pounding. You feel that kind of shortness of breath. So just understanding what's happening physiologically when you worry, I think, is a really helpful tool. So then if you start to kind of notice the worry thoughts, some people notice their physiological symptoms first, like their heart rate. Some people notice their thoughts first. So whatever you notice first, but anytime you notice yourself kind of getting activated in that way, just even remembering, okay, my body thinks I'm facing a real danger. Let me take a deep breath. That immediately brings on the part of your brain that slows down the fight or flight response and kind of starts to calm you down. And even saying aloud or kind of thinking to yourself, everything's okay right now. I'm having a worry thought about a future event. So literally kind of narrating what's happening for your brain then helps everybody kind of work together. And then you can calm down a little bit. Even if you're still having the worry thoughts, you're not going to have as much of the physiological symptoms, which again then leads to long-term stress diseases, immune compromisation, which of course is also not great right now. So that's a huge piece of it. The, you know, the kind of political situation and the race-related issues that we're facing right now, that's another just real activating situation. And again, where there's genuine threat there for many people. So it's, we can't just simply say, you know, that's your anxiety talking. So again, it's that balance of, okay, I'm noticing I'm getting activated. I'm, you know, having a fear response. What is this based on? Where is this coming from? If it is kind of a real threat situation, obviously managing it one way versus, okay, this is bringing up this. And so again, reminding yourself of kind of what's happening internally. Always start with a deep breath or, you know, two or three to just, that at least calms your body down. And the more your body's spiraling, the more your brain is having a harder time kind of bringing that logical side of the thinking on board. So that's, again, where we're just trying to be aware of all those pieces and putting them together. The last piece I'll just talk about is that behavior piece. So what happens with anxiety is we're often, what it prompts us to do is avoid, right? So if I'm anxious of something, I'm going to avoid it. And so that's another piece that you want to be aware of is what could I do that would kind of tell my body that everything's okay? And so some of that is, again, if it's not a real threat situation, then kind of confronting that, any of those social anxieties. A lot of folks are struggling a lot with hard conversations around, you know, social distancing. Will you come over for dinner? No, I'm not comfortable for that. So a lot of, even with the real stressors happening, often there's a social kind of connotation that adds to the stress for folks. So kind of, again, teasing that apart and just taking a deep breath and doing what you can.
You mentioned potentially using CBT in conjunction with other psychotherapies. Is that common for people to do?
You know, it's more and more people are kind of calling themselves integrated therapists. And so they'll pull from different orientations. Again, because CBT is so kind of instructive and skills based, it gives you a lot of tangible tools that you can use with clients. Like, we often track those automatic thoughts that come up when you're anxious. We have, you know, specific kind of labels for ways our thinking can get off. We have, you know, ways to start challenging that or exploring that. So I think that can be helpful in a lot of different modalities. There's some newer kind of, I guess, expansions of CBT that we call third wave behavior therapies. And that's things like dialectical behavior therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy. And those are also showing really good evidence base and are incorporating more of the kind of mindfulness piece to all of this, as well as, particularly with acceptance and commitment therapy, less kind of fighting against the emotion, which CBT does a little bit of, because again, you're so focused on kind of controlling the symptoms, whereas acceptance and commitment therapy works a little more around what do you want in your life? And then how is anxiety holding you back from that? And then really the goal is just to live the life and let anxiety kind of come along. So a big piece of that therapy is just really making peace with your anxiety, not reacting to your anxiety, just so accepting literally that, you know, you may have a little anxiety along for the ride, but trying to focus more on living a life that's in line with your values and making sure the anxiety isn't shifting your life in a direction that you don't want it to go. So those, I think, work really nicely together because they're kind of evolutions of CBT. So it's got some of the same premises and kind of thinking, but it tackles it from a different angle, especially again, if someone's kind of stuck in, they've maybe seen an initial reduction in symptoms, but then have plateaued and, you know, kind of want to work another angle to move forward.
I think a lot of us are getting used to really not looking at our feelings, right? Just sort of going through the motions to get through the day, trying to get through the pandemic, trying to get through the election. And I wonder if you could speak to kind of the value, if there is one, and I think there is, of checking in with ourselves every day to just sort of take a look at where we are. And I think there's kind of a numbness that overtakes people. And I wonder if you can talk to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, as you've alluded to, that's happening so much right now because our, you know, our nervous system is just overloaded. There's genuine crises happening all around us. And then folks are either kind of on top of that dealing with job loss and or having to just kind of continue on as if the world were not falling apart kind of all around us. So that I think is a real characteristic that, you know, is predominant in our society more than others, where there isn't, you know, built-in pauses for us to acknowledge everything that's happening and what kind of might be coming up with that. So we really are encouraged to numb and to just kind of continue on. And so I think as a culture, we've become pretty emotion phobic because we're focused on, you know, production and bottom line and, you know, productivity. But what happens from a psychological standpoint is if you're feeling sad, you know, for whatever it is, but you kind of shove it down because you don't have time for it, that does not go away. It usually gets bigger. So what can happen is you have an increase in avoidance behaviors, which are things like, you know, drinking more, scrolling more, just doing the things that typically are less healthy for us that help us numb out more. So you might see that, or you just see the sadness getting bigger and bigger and bigger until you're at work and kind of burst into tears on a Zoom call or whatever it might be. So as much as we can, making that pause for ourselves. And that's, I think, where a lot of the mindfulness piece comes in and has been shown to be so effective, is it's helping us build space. And it really doesn't have to be as long as we kind of imagine. If you even just pause for a moment, take that deep breath as always, and kind of check in with your emotions, acknowledge that you're feeling sad, even just that momentary kind of check in with yourself and just noticing it, naming it. The other thing that's happening right now that's so confusing is often we're having a lot of emotions at one time. So it's like messy. It's like, I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm overwhelmed. And so that's a piece of it, is naming everything that's happening to you. Again, some people like to write it down as a way to really acknowledge it. Other people, if they've been doing this for a while, just kind of saying it to yourself, thinking it to yourself, thinking, is there anything I could do nice for myself to kind of help with this? Depending on what you're feeling, in the same way that you'd kind of brainstorm that for a friend who is feeling that same way. And usually then it's gonna interfere with your life more. So it's that same kind of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, you know, concept, where the more we can kind of tune in and attend to our emotions in the moment, the less likely we're going to have that buildup of, you know, stress or emotion that's then just going to spill over in inopportune times that does end up interfering more with our lives.
When you're having that buildup and you feel that you're about to be at that point where the cup runs over, are there certain tricks or questions that we can ask ourselves to maybe pull, you know, make the water recede a little bit and come back to a closer place where we can handle that situation?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you think about kind of soothing yourself, you want to think about all the different senses that you have, right? And kind of utilize everything. So first off, depending where you are, if you can kind of remove yourself from a public situation, that's ideal to give yourself some space. And then you're thinking about, okay, thoughts, thought-wise, you know, saying some calming statements to myself. Physiologically, what can I do to kind of bring myself back in the moment? So again, always starting with the deep breath. But then if you need more of a kind of shock, for some people, like splashing cold water on their face, drinking a glass of water. So it's kind of pulling you out of your thoughts or whatever it is and into a more calm state. Smelling something soothing, looking out the window, saying a calming statement. So kind of trying to pull on every tool that you have to calm yourself before you kind of proceed. So again, it doesn't have to necessarily take long, but the more that you can kind of tackle all those different senses. So calm my brain down, calm my body down, calm my thoughts down. You know, what can I do across the board?
I've been hearing lately about people that I know just in my circle doing virtual group therapy. And I've been thinking, like, that's brilliant, right? Because you're sort of getting beyond the isolation, but also taking care of yourself. I wonder if you have any experience with that or can speak to how people can find those kinds of groups.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's cool that we're seeing in the mental health field right now is we've, you know, had some resistance to teletherapy, telemedicine, you know, in part because there is such a magic that can come from two people being in the room and kind of working through things. But what we've also always dealt with is a real difficulty accessing mental health services, whether it's a resource issue or a time issue. So there also are, I think, a lot of benefits that we're seeing in the ways we can utilize technology to kind of connect. So absolutely, I think that's, you know, a great option right now because you're getting both the therapy and, like you're saying, kind of a built-in supportive community. And right now, most folks are offering at least some electronic or telehealth versions of their services. So you can pretty much right now search in the same way you always would and assume that you're going to be able to find some virtual options. So Psychology Today is always a great, you know, search engine to kind of start with. But also if there's a particular, you know, area of concern, just even Googling support groups, you know, that aren't necessarily even therapist affiliated can be similarly helpful.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Roche. This has been so helpful.
Very, very useful. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Hey, Brian, did you know the world sucks right now?
You know, I'd kind of noticed that because, yeah, every day I wake up, I'm like, is this really real life? I would say yes, it sucks.
Yeah. There's a lot of sucky things in the world right now, and we're started a new podcast that's going to fix it.
So I guess we should probably introduce ourselves. My name is Brian Kahn. I'm the managing editor at Earther.
And I'm Alex Kranz, the senior consumer tech editor at Gizmodo.
And we're here to tell you about a new podcast that we're doing at Gizmodo focused on...
everything, fixing it, making it better, making the world suck a little less. It's called System Reboot. And we're covering a lot of important stuff that we think is really worth hearing and learning about.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of systemic failures across the country and around the world. That, you know, the pandemic has really highlighted them, but they've been there all along. And we thought, you know, there has to be a better way to do things.
There has to be, from the disastrous food supply chain issues we witnessed really early on in the pandemic, to the absolutely shoddy internet that we also saw early on and are seeing a lot more of right now as everybody returns to school. We're going to be diving into the systems that are failing us across the board.
And more importantly than examining the things that are failing, we're actually going to talk about what we can do to fix them. That's the whole system reboot idea.
Yeah, positivity, man.
Yeah, it's kind of novel. We're going to try this out and see how it goes. But you know what we're going to be doing is talking to experts who've spent a lot of time researching these issues and coming up with solutions.
So if you don't want to believe that the world is going to end in 2020 and you want to hold on to just a little bit of hope, please check us out.
And join us on our quest to fix what's broken.
Now for our interview with Dr. David Burns. Dr. Burns played a major role in making cognitive behavioral therapy a more commonly used mental health approach, and his latest book, Feeling Great, takes CBT a step further by addressing challenges and motivations in depressed or anxious patients. Here, he speaks with us about his new approach, what it is, and what makes it revolutionary.
So Dr. Burns, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be on your program. This is my second time, and the first time was awesome. So
I know.
I'm excited to be coming back.
Welcome back.
Yeah, good to have you back. The last time you were with us was 2018, when I think we all felt like we're as anxious as we're ever going to get, right? Like we're experiencing the height of anxiety.
And, we were so naive.
Right. Then 2020 came around and said, hold my beer.
Oh, yeah.
Here we are. Just thinking, what could possibly get worse? And every week there's something else. And
yeah.
But you've come right in time with a new book, No Longer Content to Feel Good. Now we're feeling great. Can you tell us a little bit about the new book and why? But, you know, we kind of know the answer, but tell us anyway.
Well, Share Feeling Good came out in 1980 and represented the technology of that era, which at the time was mind-blowing and a huge breakthrough in psychotherapy. But now it's 40 years later. I've had 40 years of research. I've had over 40,000 hours treating people with depression and anxiety, and there have been many new techniques, many new developments. So it was a time to really write the first true sequel to Feeling Good, Feeling Great. And it should be even more effective for readers than Feeling Good, because it has all of the great techniques in Feeling Good, but tremendous new techniques I've developed in the last 10 years in my weekly training group at Stanford.
For someone who had read the book 40 years ago, what's an example of one of the big revolutions or one of the big changes that has come up from 40 years ago to today?
Well, the huge thing in Feeling Good was that your thoughts create all of your moods in the here and now. And that when you're depressed and anxious, the thoughts that are making you miserable are distorted with like all or nothing thinking and self-blame and mind reading and fortune telling and should statements. And when you change the way you think, you can change the way you feel. And this can happen rapidly. And that's what the new book is all about, a new technology in addition to cognitive therapy. It's like cognitive therapy on steroids.
When someone's feeling depressed, they can often feel a lot of difficulty even having the motivation to improve their situation or improve how they're feeling. Can you describe
Yeah.
what can maybe spark that motivation or get someone to do the work required to potentially feel better afterwards?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what the whole focus of my research has been on. What sucks people into depression so they resist treatment? And in the old days, and this is what we've kind of maybe turned upside down, people used to think, oh, those people who were fighting treatment and they seem stuck in their depression, they want to feel sorry for themselves or they have secondary gains. They want it trying to get attention from people. And that's how therapists since the time of Freud have been thinking about resistance and why people get stuck in depression. But there's two problems with those interpretations. First of all, they're really hurtful to people. They're insulting. It's like a put down to people. So they don't help anybody. And most of the time, they're not even true. And what we've discovered is that people get stuck in depression, and also anxiety and relationship problems and habits and addictions for different reasons. But people get stuck in depression and anxiety because your symptoms are actually the expression of what's most beautiful and awesome about you. For example, one of the women in Feeling Great was a woman I treated in front of a live audience in San Francisco, and she'd been depressed for 9 years since a traumatic event involving her 12-year-old daughter. Her 12-year-old daughter said, can I go out and play, Mommy, after dinner? And she said, yeah, okay, no problem, because she'd gone out to play after dinner every day for years. And then some neighborhood boys snuck up on her daughter and shot her in the face with a high-powered pellet rifle. And the bullet hit her tooth, which exploded and kind of ripped through her mouth. And she ran inside screaming, blood was gushing out of her mouth and required multiple surgeries on her daughter and 9 years of failed therapy for her daughter for post-traumatic stress disorder. And Karen was upset. Now, the cognitive therapy idea is your daughter's trauma, horrible as it was, isn't causing your depression and your guilt and shame and anxiety. It's your distorted thoughts. And when you change the way you think, you can change the way you feel. And her thoughts, sure enough, were very distorted. She was saying, it's my fault that she got shot. I never should have let her go out and play after dinner. I'm a failure as a mother. And then she was feeling intense anxiety, telling herself the people in the audience who are watching this also think I'm a bad mother. And she believed those thoughts. But before I can get her to challenge them, I've got to show her how beautiful and awesome her negative thoughts and feelings are. And so we do something called positive reframing before I show her how to crush those distorted thoughts. And what it is to ask her to make a list. Let's make a list together of what your negative thoughts and feelings show about you that's positive and awesome. And just to give you an example, I said to Karen, here's a magic button. Let's imagine there's a magic button. If you push it, all your negative thoughts and feelings will disappear instantly, and you'll go into a state of euphoria. Will you press it? She said, oh, in a heartbeat, I'd press it. I say, okay, but let's slow down a little bit here. I've got some awesome techniques. Maybe we can make all your symptoms disappear by the end of the session, but I don't know if it's such a good idea. And she said, why not? I said, well, what does your sadness and depression show about you that's positive and awesome? See, if you press that button, your depression, which you now rate at 100 out of 100, the worst depression possible, will go to zero and you'll be euphoric. Are you sure you want to be euphoric about the fact that your daughter is suffering horribly? Jesus, oh no, you're right. You see, so that's a simple, obvious one. Her sadness and depression shows her love for her daughter. And then her guilt, what does that show? She says, I'm a failure as a mother. What does that show about her that's positive and awesome? Anything come to mind?
She has high standards for herself as a mother. She has empathy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. High standards. I said, do you have high standards, Karen? She said, oh, absolutely. I said, add that to the list. Is that important? She says, oh yeah, I do everything I can for my daughter. I have high standards in my career. I got a PhD in clinical psychology. So, okay, let's add all of that. What else does your guilt show about you that's positive and awesome? And she said, well, humility, maybe? And I said, awesome. Is that real? She said, yes. I said, is that important? She says, yes, I'm a very religious person. I've been praying for 9 years for my depression to go away. It didn't work, but I'm a very religious person, and humility is very important. And I said, well, how about you're telling yourself that those people in the audience right now are judging you, looking down on you and thinking you're a failure as a mother? What does that thought show about you that's positive and awesome? And she couldn't come up with anything. I said, well, what does that show the kind of relationship you want with the people in the audience? She says, oh, it shows that I want a warm, open, loving relationship where I don't have to hide things and I can be close to people. So I said, is that a good thing, your desire to be close to colleagues? She says, oh, absolutely. And so we came up with about 25 things, just like this, totally awesome things about her. And I said, well, now, Karen, if you press that magic button, sure, all your negative thoughts and feelings will instantly vanish. But all these beautiful things will go down the toilet along with your negative thoughts and feelings. Why in the world would you want to do that? And now I put her into a kind of a paradox in a way. On the one hand, she wants to get better. On the other hand, she realizes, here's why I've been depressed for 9 years. My depression is my love for my daughter. My anxiety is my mother bear's desire to protect her. My anger is justified. Those parents never should have let their boys go out and play with a loaded rifle. And then say, well, maybe instead of pressing that magic button, let's imagine we have a magic dial and we could dial it, each of them down. Is there some lower level of sadness and depression that you could feel better? We could dial it down to some level where you'd still have all your love for your daughter, but you wouldn't be 100% depressed and incapacitated. How much depression would you want? And she says, oh, 10% is enough. I said, are you sure? Can I sell you on 20%? And then she laughed. She said, no, 10 is plenty. And then she decided the level she wanted for shame and guilt and hopelessness and anger you know, like 5% of this and 2% of this and 10% of that. And now I've like made a deal with her subconscious resistance to where she can dial them down. She's in control and she doesn't have to give up all these beautiful parts of herself. And once we did that, then it was really easy for her to crush her negative thoughts. And so bringing out to people, here's why you've been stuck in depression. It's such a shock to them.
My mind is blown by this because I think about my own experience with therapy, right? Where you do sort of go through your distorted thought patterns and discuss, you know, why they're distorted and how you can correct them. And then you come back the next week and you're back to the same stuff, yeah. Even if you're not, and you're not fully aware of it all the time, because there's all of this other subconscious stuff, right, shuffling around in your brain. Yeah. So why is your technique, how is it such a game changer? Why would it work that quickly?
Well, because the resistance wasn't dealt with in the original cognitive therapy. It was just, as you say, all about changing these distorted thoughts. And half the time it works great, and half the time it doesn't work so well. And so I did research, how does psychotherapy work? Even though I was in private practice, I've always collected data on my patients to find out what's the difference between the patients who get better and stay better and the ones who seem slow to recover or they don't improve. And then I discovered it was all about motivation and resistance, that was the missing dimension. And that just transformed my thinking and my practice. And then with my group at Stanford, I've developed these new resistance busting techniques, and it just has transformed everything. There's another thing too, is that once someone recovers, see, I don't know how much you improve in a session, but if you're measuring it, I don't call recovery until you're in a euphoric state. And then I do relapse prevention training. Because I tell the person, well, you know, these are going to come back, these negative thoughts. Here's the technique that works for you. Let's practice now what you're going to do when they come back.
Can you share some of those relapse prevention techniques? You know, if someone's beginning to have these negative thoughts that are familiar to what they felt before, what are some of the questions that they could ask themselves, the things that they could do to slow that down? And also, yeah. You know, since so many of us are struggling with depression and anxiety right now, that means many of us know people or are living with people who are having those challenges. Are there certain do's or don'ts or questions that a partner or a friend can ask to help spur that person, you know, without being a mental health professional?
Yeah, well, let's take the second question first, although they're both amazing questions. But being elderly and half demented, I can remember the second one. The first one is long-term memory recall. But most people don't know how to help a loved one. They try to cheer them up or tell them to correct their distorted thoughts, and that is never going to be effective. And what you need to learn is compassionate listening. And that to give you an example, when I'm working, you know, with a loved one or a family member, I generally don't try to do therapy, but to be like a compassionate father or friend. After my daughter's baby was born, she never wanted to get married or have a baby. She was dead set on it. And then all of a sudden something changed and she got married and wanted to have a baby and had a baby. But then she would say to me, and she loves her little guy tremendously, but she would say to me things like, oh Dad, you know, I'm in prison now for 18 years and I won't be able to do my Aikido anymore. And you know, I'm trapped. And I tried not to help her in any way, but just to buy into what she's saying. In a loving way, say, Senia, you know, you're right. There's tremendous demands on you and on mothers, and it is kind of unfair, all the pressures on mothers, and you have to give so much, and you have to give up all kinds of activities, and you're right, it's like you're in prison now, and he's lucky to have such a beautiful, wonderful mother, but my heart goes out to you. I totally agree with you. Now, notice I'm not trying to help her, and then she would say, but on the other hand, Dad, I love my baby and I'm as happy as can be. You know, it's just listening and providing support rather than trying to cheer someone up or throw help at them. And that's an art form, and you can learn how to do it. Now, what was your first question? That was also a mind blower.
Yeah, the first question was about how to address it yourself. You know, you were mentioning those relapse prevention techniques. What are some of those questions you could ask yourself?
Yeah, well, there's three things I tell people for relapse prevention, the three parts to it. Number one, I'd say, I want you to know that there's 100% guarantee that you're going to relapse forever. And what a relapse is 1 minute or more of feeling like crap. And that's okay. And it's okay to feel lousy for a minute, an hour, or even a day, because that's part of the human condition. You're only entitled to 5 happy days per week and 2 miserable days. And if you don't have your 5 happy days, you need a mental tune-up. If you don't have your 2 miserable days, you're getting too happy. So we're going to have to put you on lithium, because no one's entitled to be that happy. So that's the first thing, is set a proper expectation, because we all get upset. I'm one of the happiest guys you'd ever meet. But I would say in an average day, I probably get upset 5 times. You know, life has bumps in the road. You get ticked off at people. But having the capacity to pop out of it and to know that you can do that, that's what's crucial. Secondly, I tell the person, the technique that you learn from me that work for you. See, I've developed more than 100 techniques, but the patient will only need one. And we try to find that one as quickly as possible. And because there's this idea of fractals, a fractal is a pattern that repeats itself over and over again in nature. And that's what depression is. It's just a few neural circuits that keep doing exactly the same thing to the patient. And there's the same thing will provoke the depression, and then they'll have exactly the same thinking pattern. And so the technique that I work out with them, that technique will work for them for the rest of their life, and they have to know that.
So now, these days, we're all filled with various types of anxiety.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about pandemic anxiety. And I'd imagine that in everybody, it takes a different form. Some people are worried about their parents, some are worried about their children, some are worried about their jobs. And of course, like, there are valid reasons to be anxious. So how do you tell what's sort of reasonable anxiety and what's distorted thinking? And then how do you kind of get to the bottom of that and feel better?
It's the same thing. When people are depressed or anxious, you're giving yourself distorted messages. My research shows that in women, since the pandemic, depression has doubled, anxiety has doubled, anger has doubled, and hopelessness has doubled. In men, anger has doubled. So there is a big increase, but it's the same things. It's your thoughts, not the corona, that's causing your upset. And when you're depressed and anxious, the things you're telling yourself will not be true.
Dr. Burns, thank you so much. This has really been great.
So much to think about here. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Yeah, I can't thank you people enough from the bottom of my heart. You're both awesome interviewers and awesome people. It was just such a joy for me to hang out with you a little bit. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Danielle Belton, editor-in-chief of The Root.
And I'm Maisha Kai, managing editor of The Glow Up.
And this September, we're excited to bring you The Root Presents It's Lit.
It's Lit is a podcast where we talk about all things literature, literally.
More specifically, Black literature.
And we have some incredible guests lined up, including Nicole Hannah-Jones.
The last thing I want is us to produce anything like The Green Book.
Ijoma Alu.
Why this book? why aren't we all picking up the How to Burn Down the System book? You know, like, why can't we do that right now?
The venerable Claudia Rankine.
I can't really separate the subject out from the structure. And the two things for me are actually what makes writing exciting.
And so many more brilliant Black authors, writers, and thought leaders.
We're speaking with some of the most distinguished voices in Black literature about their work, the books that influence them, and a lot more.
So please join us every Friday for some thought-provoking conversations. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And keep it lit.
Whoop, whoop.
Time for our upgrade of the week, where we talk about one tiny thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Jordan, what's your upgrade this week?
So you know that old saying, what is it? What gets measured gets managed. Mm-hmm. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay. So I wanted to manage my word count in a way that I normally do during National Novel Writing Month.
I thought you meant your spoken word count.
Normally I speak about X thousands of words a day. No, normally I write in November for NaNoWriMo. I will write, you know, the 1700 words a day or so. And whether I get above or below that, I would keep track of it. And now I want to be able to do that outside of NaNoWriMo and to be able to keep track of my words just to see how many I write. And I think it'll help me with consistency when it comes to writing a certain amount each day. So I found this site, and there's probably a million of them out there, but a site that just lets you keep track of your word count throughout the day. This one is wordkeeperalpha.com by just some software engineer who created it and put it out there for free. And I can keep track of my word count every day and have a bar graph to see what it looks like. And I'm guessing that that's going to do a good job, hopefully at least, of being able to manage my behavior when it comes to writing on a consistent basis.
Does it measure everything you're writing, like emails and
No. Text? You just plug in every day. It's pretty simple. You plug in the same way that you might on NaNoWriMo's site, if you ever did NaNoWriMo before. You would just plug in your number of how many words you wrote that day. So today I wrote 250, tomorrow I wrote 1,000, the next day I wrote none, and then I'll just show you a bar graph over time. So it's just a tracker. Just an online tracker to keep track of how many words you said that you wrote that day or that week.
So it's the honor system. You're putting the word
absolute down. Honor system. Yep, absolute honor system. You just plug in how many words, and you could do this on your own. You don't really need a site to do it, but a site just gives you some cool visuals and data, so you get to see what your writing looks like during a different season or a different month or a different week.
Yeah, I like a bar graph.
Yeah, I dig it. Got some pie graphs in there. Got some line graphs. I like all this visual stuff. This
nice.
Data. I'm just going to big data the shit out of my life. Alice, what's your upgrade this week?
I think it's the opposite of yours, which is that I have been spending most of my time these days managing my anxiety by shopping online for real estate, and not in a realistic way, just like looking at websites that list.
Just doing some Zillow browsing?
Totally. We are 100% in on Zillow browsing, and just coming up with ideas that are more and more unrealistic about what we can buy. I'm like, this house has a chapel for some reason. Literally found a house with a chapel. Like the more and more upstate you go, the crazier things you can find for less and less money. And I'm like, right. I could do a 3-hour commute.
I feel like that's the new window shopping, you know, like in
it
the
is.
Past, it used to be walking through, you know, expensive Fifth Avenue stores and looking inside and seeing things that you would never actually pay for. Mm-hmm. And now we're scrolling through Zillow and looking at houses and looking at things that we cannot afford. But it's
right.
sort of fun to imagine.
I almost enjoy more the houses that are sort of realistic for us to afford, because they're so shitty that there's a history behind them. It's not a glossy, beautiful house with a pool and a tennis court. No. It's like a weird cape with blood red carpeting for some reason. And the rooms which are like, there's a ghost in that room for sure. Like there's just a lot of like
65% like, chance that's like, haunted.
Which room did somebody definitely die in at one point? It's really fun. I've been really enjoying it. That's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. Help us continue to help you by sharing this with other people. You can also reach us by calling at 347-687-8109 and leaving us a voicemail, or you can write to us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter @Lifehacker, on Instagram @Lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook.com/Lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter, full of tips and tricks and hacks, at Lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at Lifehacker.com/the show.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.